I think it helps to like answer the question, like, what's the purpose of an FTP test? Yep. And that's to find your steady power output that you could theoretically hold for an hour, which should be somewhere close to your lactate threshold, which is the point at which you're buffering lactate at the same rate that you're accumulating it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast, powered by Ignition Coach Co. I'm your host, Adam Savin. On this week's episode, Drew and I are talking about how to approach training through injuries, preparation ideas for Everesting attempts, and the differences between ramp testing and the standard 20-minute FTP protocol. Today's show is also brought to you by Flow Formulas. We're already a third of the way through 2024, which means if you haven't already dialed in your nutrition plan for the season, you'd better get on it stat. Head over to flowformulas.com today and make sure to use the discount code MATCHBOX when checking out. As always, if you like what you hear, please share this with your friends and leave us a five-star review. And if you have any questions for the show, you can drop us an email at matchboxpod@gmail.com with email title The Matchbox Podcast, or you can head over to ignitioncoachco.com and fill out the Matchbox Podcast listener question form. All right, let's get into it. We need that that theme song where it's like, just the two of us.
Yeah, right, right.
Just Drew and I today. Everyone else had to bug out, so bear with us.
Yeah, Dylan didn't have a very good reason, though. He just said it was unbound training time.
Like, dude. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if that means he's training from sunup to sundown, but he was certainly up super early this morning to try and, like, when he texted us this morning that he wasn't going to be able to make it, it was 5 a.m. his time, which that's not like him.
Yeah.
Okay, so this first question this week, this one comes from Jason. He's got a question about FTP testing, which I thought this would be a good one because I remember you did a video on FTP testing a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So Jason says,
YouTube videos.
Yeah, and it was good. Ramp test versus 20 minute test? Hey, Matchbox, thanks for the insights and laughs over the past few years. I have a question about how to best define my FTP and thereby hit my target zones. I'm a short, muscular rider at 5'7", 170-ish pounds. I can squat pretty heavy and have a decent sprint, but I really love XC marathon mountain bike racing. This doesn't seem to be what I'm genetically inclined to excel at, but it's what I prefer nonetheless. Which, hey, if you're not trying to do this for, you know, professionally and, like, you know, make any money off of doing this, like, more power to you to do what you enjoy, right? I mean, you don't have to do what you're best at. If you enjoy marathon mountain bike racing, even though you might be better at XC mountain bike racing, like, stick to it. That's awesome. You can always get better at that. So I'm curious if I should be using a ramp test or a 20-minute effort to determine my FTP. The 20-minute FTP is 25 to 30 watts lower than when I do a ramp test. When I use the 20-minute number, the ranges feel pretty accurate for my tempo and threshold workouts, but when I get up to VO2 max and sprints, the ranges feel low. If I use the ramp test number, the opposite is true. Tempo and threshold efforts feel impossible, but the VO2 max and sprint ranges feel spot on. Should I keep using the ramp test number, but just prioritize threshold intervals, or should I use the 20-minute test and be okay with relatively high, easy output workouts? Or relatively easy high output workouts. Could I use two different numbers, one for threshold and below, and the other one for VO2 max and sprints? Any help would be appreciated. Thanks, Jason.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've never done a ramp test, so I can't like speak firsthand. Yeah, I can't speak firsthand about like how good or not good a ramp test is, and I've honestly not done a ton of research on ramp testing, but I have, you know, obviously done a lot of 20-minute tests. I've even done a 60-minute power test before. If Siler were to answer this question, he would say the only way to get an accurate FTP is to do a 60-minute power test. And that's what he does. And he's not even
like or lab testing, right?
Yeah, just straight up lactate testing.
Yeah.
I think it helps to like answer the question, like, what's the purpose of an FTP test? And that's to find your steady power output that you could theoretically hold for an hour, which should be somewhere close to your lactate threshold, which is the point at which you're buffering lactate at the same rate that you're accumulating it. So you can do that with testing, like blood testing, or you can just do it based off of like basically perceived effort, because if you can ride for an hour at your max power, well, then that's probably pretty darn close to wherever your lactate threshold is, because you wouldn't be able to do that for an hour if otherwise. So a 20 yep. minute test is a little bit better versus like a shorter test. I think these ramp tests are shorter because I think the longer the duration, the more accurate it becomes. So like I used to do 8 minute power tests and I would have the same thing happen where my power zones were a little bit skewed too high because I could kind of fake an 8 minute test. And basically what you would do with an 8 minute test is take 90% of whatever your 8 minute power was. And then with a 20 minute test, you take 95% of that number. But even with the difference in percentage output or whatever, my FTP was still a little too high with the 8 minute tests. And I've found that the 20 minute test is pretty spot on. So I would tell him to do the 20 minute test if I were coaching him. But then again, I don't know exactly how those ramp tests work. Like, I think it's just the power gets higher and higher and higher until you can't hold it, which
yeah,
in my mind, that's not a steady effort. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how they're grabbing the number that they're getting, but
yeah. So, I mean, the interesting thing with ramp tests is they were developed, actually, like ramp tests were originally kind of developed for like VO2 max testing, like in lab mm-hmm. for lab testing. Yeah. And the thing with most ramp tests, you know, the protocols nowadays and how the algorithms that correspond, they've got a ton of data to help mm-hmm. kind of back up, you know, where the estimates are. But it's just the way that it works is you kind of start at a relatively low, you know, like endurance zone, and then every minute it bumps up a percentage. So, you know, it might bump up 10 watts or 15 watts every minute, and then you go until it fail, basically. And that's why a lot of people like the ramp test, because you don't, it takes pacing completely out the window, especially for people that are training. You can only do it really inside. You can't do this outside. But if you're on a trainer and you're using like erg mode where it's controlling the power output for you, it makes it really easy. Like all you do is just keep going as hard as you can. And then eventually you just can't go anymore. And then what it'll do is it'll take your highest 1 minute power and multiply it by some number. It's usually like 72 to 74%, depending on the protocol and the algorithm. And then it spits out an FTP estimate from there. But kind of, you know, like you're talking about in what we're seeing with Jason here is you can kind of cheat the system a little bit. I've actually found that for me, ramp tests usually give me a much lower number. For whatever reason, I just can't get a good, I've never executed a good ramp test relative yeah. to an 8 minute or 20 minute test outdoors. But I think for me, that's mostly because of the indoor aspect, not because of the ramp test itself. It's just, I can't put out as good of numbers inside. Yeah. But I would say for Jason here, like specifically for him, and for anyone out there, I think it's much more important to have a good estimate of where your tempo and threshold zones are than mm-hmm. what your power number, you know, zones are for VO2 max and above. Yeah. Because once you get into those higher output efforts, you really should be kind of going max effort for the duration. You know, if you're doing 3 minute effort, it should be like a max effort. If you're doing 5 minute effort, it should be, you know, more or less a max effort. You know, so it's a lot easier to just kind of like throw out the power targets in the range, you know, the power zones once you get higher, because you're really just going more off of perceived exertion. Whereas tempo, especially in thresholds, because you can extend, you can hold those efforts for longer. You know, theoretically, let's say your threshold is 300 watts, that means you can hold that for an hour. So if you're doing a 3x20 minute threshold effort, which would be a really hard session, you can still hold, you should be able to hold 300 watts for 20 minutes fairly easily relative to holding it for an hour, which is theoretically what you could do. So you really want to know so that way you can hit that zone. You don't want to be hitting too much above it. You definitely don't want to hit below the zone. Like those tempo and threshold, I think it's a lot harder to pace off of perceived exertion than it is the harder efforts. So for Jason here, I would say like if the 20 minute number gets you more accurate threshold and tempo ranges, that's what I would stick with. And then kind of throw out the power targets or the ranges for those harder efforts and more or less go off of RPE or establish your own.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say the same thing about, like once you get to VO2 intervals, you're basically going as hard as you can go for the amount of time. At least that's how I always describe it. So those power zones, like even if they're a little off and you go a little over them, not that big of a deal. But if you go over your, if you're always training over your tempo zone, then that could be like a recipe for disaster and overtraining.
Exactly.
Another thing I was going to say was I remember reading, and I might like, this is off of memory. So I don't have just like a collection or a database of scientific articles memorized like Dylan does, but I do remember reading in one of these Matt Fitzgerald books about this, the testing protocol. And there's two different ways you can do testing protocol. It's like an open loop system or closed loop system. Like, I don't know if those are the right terms or not, but so a ramp test would be an open loop because you don't know where exactly the finish line is. A 20-minute test would be more of a closed loop because you know the finish line's 20 minutes in. And I think psychologically, humans or athletes tend to do better with a closed loop system like a race because it more mimics a race with a given finish line. An open loop system where you're just going until failure, it's harder to push mentally when you don't know where the finish line is. I remember reading.
Yeah. And with the ramp test too, so kind of on that similar note, depending on whether you're using erg mode versus standard mode or whatever, where you might be using power match or whatever, where it's actually getting data from your power meter, but you're just given a target and you're trying to hit that target for the given minute, you're going to get pretty different numbers depending on that. Because what can happen is as you're getting closer to what it feels like the finish line, but it's not an actual finish line because, like you're saying, it's an open loop system. You don't really know what that finish line is, but your body starts to get a little bit anxious. It gets a little bit impatient, mm-hmm. and it just wants to go really hard towards the end. So you might actually end up going to fail prematurely because you just want to get to that finish line, in which case you're actually inflating your numbers because you're not following the step progression as the protocol, would lay out. Whereas if it's in erg mode, it doesn't let you do that. It just, you're going to hit that number spot on every single time. So it doesn't let you get ahead. So depending on which mode you're using, you could get different numbers.
Yeah.
So hopefully that helps, Jason, and anyone else out there that's interested in, I would say the biggest thing too is staying consistent. Mm-hmm. If you're going to use the ramp test, use the ramp test every single time. Try and put that ramp test in your training plan at the same, a similar spot, whether it's at the end of a rest week or at the end of a training block, keep it pretty consistent there, and try and keep as many variables out of the equation as you can. Cause that's really what we're trying to do is we're just trying to track progression and, establish your training zones somewhat accurately. And the reason they're zones is because it's always kind of a moving target. So that's why there's some flexibility there. But I would say that, in this case here, like if you notice that you're basically off a whole training zone from one test to the other, then, kind of follow what we're saying is and go with the one that's going to give you the more accurate threshold or sub-threshold zones.
Yeah, I think some people get a little too worked up with their FTP tests and they're like, I'll hear people say like, oh, I got to taper for my test or I got to... and it's like, I don't know, like it might not be that, like it's a test and we just want to see what your FTP is. It's not exactly like this isn't a defining moment of like your value as an athlete or anything like that. Like the races are much more important because that's like where you're going to get a result. This is just to see where your fitness is and we're going to do another test in a couple months. And so, yeah, I think some people just get a little too over, maybe anxious. I mean, it is a big deal, but like not that big of a deal.
Yeah, and that's actually why a lot of times once we get into like a middle of the build phase or getting closer to the race season, I don't really do like prescribed FTP tests anymore. I'll just try and, if I notice someone's hitting the high ends of their zones mm-hmm. always and their feedback is that the effort was pretty easy. And I'm like, well, it shouldn't be easy if you're hitting, 1.1 IF for 20 minutes, like clearly we're a little bit off here, then I usually just kind of base it off of training efforts and, go in and adjust things. Cause you just don't want to have that disappointment. If you catch them on a bad day or they, some people get really anxious, like you're saying about the tests and mm-hmm. you just don't want to throw that wrench in the mix during a a quality training block. You know, it's, if things are going well, who cares what the number is? We just care what the zones are.
Yeah, right, right.
Okay, let's move on to Steven from Louisiana's question. Hi, everyone. This is a good question for you. I recently had a major crash and I broke my collarbone in two places. I've been on the trainer regularly since my crash. Prior to the crash, I didn't have a trainer. I purchased one immediately following the crash. I had surgery to repair the collarbone and I'm currently 2 weeks out after surgery. According to my PT and doctor, I won't be able to ride outside again until late May. That gives me about 8 weeks on the trainer on Zwift. Any advice on recovering from this injury? What should I be doing on the trainer during these 8 weeks? So right now he's probably 3 or 4 weeks into this. Mentally, I can't wait to get back outside. My volume prior to the crash was about 12 hours per week, and I'm finally back to that same volume this week on the trainer. Whew. I haven't taken an FTP test. My FTP prior to the crash was 232 watts at 155 pounds. The only event I'm targeting this year is Six Gap. I don't know what that is. My other events were unfortunately in April and May, so I'm going to miss those. Any advice would be appreciated. I love your podcast and often listen to it while on the trainer. Thanks again.
Well, Steven from Louisiana, is that his name?
Yep.
I did a whole YouTube video on the mental side of recovery last summer because I broke my wrist. And same thing, I think I was off the bike for 6 weeks. The biggest thing I remember reading when I was injured was, when you're not injured, your main focus when you're training is to train and like get ready for racing, which obviously that makes sense. But your main focus when you're recovering from an injury is to recover. And I think sometimes we try to stay in the mindset of training when we should switch our mindset to recovering throughout that recovery process. And so just realizing like your body has to heal before you can like really, really push it. Something with like a collarbone or a wrist, you can still train, like you're saying, on the trainer. It just sucks like mentally to be on the trainer when, especially in the summer. So like, I'm right there with you, Steven. Like, this is the best time of the year to be outdoors and riding, and to not be able to is definitely a bummer.
Yeah.
But also there's this like huge, you could call it like the comeback, theory or whatever you want to call it. But like, a lot of times injured athletes come back more motivated to train than even before they were injured, because they realize like how much they love riding their bike. And, you know, you kind of take things for granted until it's taken away from you. And so this could be like a huge motivational spark, and you'll come back for the second half of the season even better than before. I know that doesn't answer any of your questions, but those were the things that I remember that like stood out to me when I was injured last summer.
You're going to come back possibly even fresher too if you don't overcook yourself during this time of recovery. And that's what worries me a little bit, hearing that Steven's already says, you know, I'm already back up to 12 hours a week on the trainer. 12 hours a week on the trainer is way different than doing 12 hours a week outside. That's going to be mentally taxing, physically taxing. You might get really fit from it, but you don't want to come out of this recovery period and feel completely smoked, because that's part of what I think too, injured athletes, when they bounce back, is all of a sudden they're like fresh again for the first time in maybe years. You know, you don't get that kind of hard reset like that too often. And not to say that should happen very frequently, like, you know, clearly during that time you're losing some fitness, but if the freshness outweighs the fitness, then that's when you can have like, you can actually see some like breakthrough PRs from that, because, you know, you're still carrying the residual fitness, but now all of a sudden you have this like rejuvenated freshness. And it's just you don't want to miss out on that too, because that's a beautiful thing when that actually comes to fruition. So definitely don't want to cook yourself too much on the trainer. And as far as like, you know, he asks, what should I be focusing on right now? I think pretty much anything that's just kind of aerobic, you know, I would stick to mainly just endurance riding, just kind of keeping the aerobic engine moving, keeping things in kind of maintenance mode. You're not trying to gain fitness here. You're just trying to maintain, if anything. And, you know, then once you get recovered fully and you can get cleared to go back on the bike, you know, then that's when you get back to some intensity once you get outside.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to even say like, he could even play around with like running I don't know like how that would feel with a collarbone. Like
sounds
how
miserable.
Far along.
Yeah. I guess with the surgery though, mm-hmm. you're usually pain free within a right. week or so. It's just yeah. how stable is it? So maybe running would actually be okay depending on mobility.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember asking all these questions, like when I went for the checkups, I'd be like, okay, so like, I know I can't ride. So can I run and can I do this? And I would go with a list of questions of like knowing, all right, I'm going to ask these questions so that I can like dial in my training a little bit more that, you know, yep. for this 2 week block. And then when I go back in 2 weeks to see the PT person, it's like, okay, what can I do now?
Yeah.
And so I remember, yeah, I was running with my like wrist brace, even just a few weeks after the injury, because, as long as I didn't fall, it was fine. But riding, I couldn't hold the handlebars with the wrist. So like there were certain things that I could do and certain things that I couldn't do. And so I think getting outside to do something would be a huge mental, you know, just stimulus, like to be able to go out. And even if you can't run, like to literally just go for like a brisk walk, which sounds so lame coming out of my mouth, but I think getting outside is going to boost your morale. Like I yeah. remember a couple days where I was just so bummed because the weather was so nice and I couldn't ride that I like watched TV all day and like was just like having a pity party, you know? And then I think at the very end of the day, like right at sunset, I got outside and like went for a little jog and that kind of like knocked me back, like knocked me out of my pity party. I was
agreed.
Like, just yep. pull yourself together. And so I think getting outside is a huge mental boost when you're injured. And like having good people around you, you know, like, people who are going to keep you focused. And, you know, like I've got a really good wife who she knew that like, I love to ride my bike and she knows that like when I can't ride my bike, it's a bummer. And she was definitely a huge help through that as well. Just like she was encouraging me and helping me. And yeah. So having good people around you definitely is a huge thing too.
For sure. Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I guess like specifically, yeah, exactly what you said. I think maintaining as much of the aerobic fitness from before his injury is going to be the goal. At maximum, I would say maybe some short tempo efforts, like, and that would be towards the end of it. Like, but I mean, to try and do like really hard efforts on the trainer would be not fun. And I don't know how much gain you're actually going to get from that.
Yeah. And like you said, it's going to impede your the recovery process, which you don't want to mm-hmm. do during this time. You want to get back to normal as soon as possible. So,
yeah, I did. Okay.
And,
so
and
this
I
was...
would, I would also make sure, you know, like Steven mentions that most of their races were in April and May, but now I don't know when the six gap races, that's what they said, right?
I think that's kind of, I think it's one of those like the triple bypass, you know, I think it's something like that where it's like a just a big day on the bike, but it's not exactly a race.
Maybe. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know when that takes place, but I certainly wouldn't try to come out of this recovery phase where you're stuck in the trainer being in race shape. Like you got to give yourself a month or two to mm-hmm. get there after you come out of this. So that's what I'm not sure when that event takes place. But even if that event is within 6 or 8 weeks after you coming out of it, like you might just have to accept like, hey, it's just going to be a training day. I'm going to come in mm-hmm. a little bit less prepared than usual, but that's just the nature of it. That's where you're at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've got to change your goals. I mean, that's like,
yep.
You broke a bone. Like you have to change your goals. Like when I broke my wrist last summer, I had to miss all of the summer road racing and crits that I had been training for all spring. But I like rechanged my goal to like, okay, now I'm going to focus on these late season gravel races. And like, dude, in October, I was flying. Like I felt so good in October because everybody else had just been racing all year without a break. And I came into the like September and October so fresh from being injured over the summer. And I had some of the best races of my career last fall. And it's like, I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying I wish I had broke my wrist before, but like some of those results was because I took such a big rest over the summer.
Right. Right. So yeah, good luck, Steven. Wish you well and hope you get back on the bike sooner than later. Okay. Last question here. This one comes from Ryan. I just recently found the podcast and it is so good. My question is regarding Everesting. I did loads of zone 2 all winter, and in the spring I switched to threshold and VO2 intervals with long endurance Saturday rides. My main question is, should I focus on a certain zone of interval for the best result? My goal is to go sub 14 hours at approximately 200 watts for each ascent. Ryan doesn't say when their event is or when they're going to do the Everesting. Maybe it's just whenever you feel like you're ready. But that's, yeah. Question is, yeah, what to do for Everesting?
Don't go out too hard. I mean, like, I don't know anything about Everesting. Again, I've never tried Everesting. I've climbed a lot. I think the most I've climbed in one ride has been kind of close to an Everest. I think I've gotten pretty close to 20K, but not an Everest is basically 30,000, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I think you're going to be super motivated and like ready to go the first probably 2, 3, 4 hours, but you just said 14 hours. And so my biggest advice would be like, always be thinking about future Drew. Like that's what I always tell myself in these long races is like, is future Drew going to be really ticked off at present Drew for the decisions he's making? And if you go into it with that mindset of like, okay, how am I going to feel 12 hours into this thing? I think that will hopefully help you to like pull back the reins a little bit and pace yourself a little bit better. Cause yeah, that's going to be a ton of pacing. And like, yeah, if I were coaching this guy again, I'd be like, that would be a big thing. And then the nutrition is going to be huge. You know, like you're going to be intaking a bunch of carbs to be able to even just ride for that long. So trying to get that as dialed as possible. But as far as intensity goes, I couldn't imagine you, I mean, 14 hours of climbing and descending. I mean, I guess you get some breaks because of the descending, but even with that, I couldn't imagine you'd be like riding even tempo zone for 14 hours. So like you're probably shooting for mid to high endurance range as far as power zones go. Maybe you're looking at your heart rate to make sure your heart rate never exceeds a certain point. Like I'll try to do that during a race. Like I'll keep a check on my heart rate more so than my power. Cause the power, I guess in a race, the power is kind of sporadic, but in this case you could hold a steady power, but I'm always like aware of like, okay, if I start to see these heart rates, I'm probably going too hard.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, with this thing, you know, with this here, I would say the two main focuses should be on trying to raise your threshold, which would, you know, come from a lot of volume and doing efforts at or above threshold. So I would kind of focus there. Especially because you're not going to ride in tempo. So like you really don't need to go out and do a bunch of tempo efforts here. And then I would throw in like one or two test rides where, you know, instead of your long endurance ride on a Saturday, like turn that into a quarter Everest or a third Everest, you know, where you're going out and trying to target 10,000 feet on the same climb kind of preparation. And I would test your pacing that way. So let's say you do a 10,000 foot effort. So a third of 14 hours is roughly five hours or so. If that climb doesn't feel still pretty easy 5 hours in at the end of that, then your pacing was too hard. Because if it doesn't feel easy at 5 hours, it's not going to feel easy, even close to easy at 14 hours. And not to say that an Everest is supposed to feel easy by the end, but it should feel sustainable the whole time, basically. Maybe in the last hour or two, you start bumping up the RPE just because you're trying to finish it sooner. But like the rest of the time, the first 12 hours should feel easy. So that's what I would say is, and I think that'd be pretty important. You can test your nutrition that way. You can test your bike setup. If it doesn't feel easy for 5 hours, you're not ready for 14 hours. It's going to be tough. Either you're going too hard, your nutrition's not dialed, or your bike fit's not set up right. So I would definitely try and, I would throw in, you know, a quarter or third Everest, you know, a couple times in before you try the actual effort.
Yeah, for sure. That's really good. Yeah. I mean, that goes for any type of racing. Like that's the entire concept of specialization, right? Like, specificity.
Specificity.
Specificity, yes.
Yep.
Is like you're going to do the exact training of what your racing requires. Like everybody should be doing that regardless of what style of racing you're doing.
Yep. Yeah. And in this case here, an endurance ride on a Saturday is a lot different than just repeating a climb. So,
yeah,
you know, you want to throw in a couple of those. Yeah. So good luck, Ryan. Report back. Let us know. I mean, we'd love to learn more about what kind of worked and what didn't work for this Everesting effort. So the next time we get a question like this, got a little bit more intel to share.
Yeah, for sure.
Sweet. We'll wrap it there. Got three questions knocked out.
All right.
All right. Sounds good, man. We'll see you.
Sweet. See ya.
All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in for the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast. Like I said at the beginning, you can send any questions or topic suggestions to matchboxpod@gmail.com with email titled The Matchbox Podcast. Links to each of our social media pages can be found in the show notes. Tune in next week for another endurance training-related discussion and learn more about how you can find that extra match for your next big event. Catch y'all soon. Let's go.
Do you feel undertrained, overtrained, burnt out, or just plain unmotivated to complete workouts? We understand, and we want to help. Cookie cutter training plans just don't get the job done like a real life coach. A training plan can't adjust when things go sideways, and a training plan doesn't hold you accountable when you slack off. A training plan can't motivate you before a big race. Only a coach can do these things. Get the most out of yourself with coaching that works. Sign up for a free consultation with an Ignition coach today, and let's get to work.